We're talking with Dar Jamil. He's joining us on Regime Change Radio from Iraq. And Dar Jamil is an independent freelance journalist from Anchorage, Alaska. He is in Iraq to tell the real story of what's going on there and not what the mainstream press is telling us. Dar, we've been getting your reports and talking about them a little bit here. Tell us a little more about some of the people that you've gotten to know while you've been in Iraq.
Yeah, along with my interpreter and another interpreter that I've worked with, one thing that's astounded me, and I actually was just starting to write about this a little bit earlier tonight, we'll go in to a home that's been stormed by soldiers, two family members detained, the home completely destroyed, and I'll interview these people, and then they'll insist that we stay for lunch, and then they'll insist that we come back so we can talk and maybe share dinner. I went up to Samarra and did a story on what happened up there when a big battle broke out in the middle of the city and eight civilians were killed, and talked with Sheikh Abbas, one of the main spiritual and political figures up in the city. And he even, one of the people killed was one of his relatives. And so we did the interview, we talked about the incident, and then he insisted that we stay for lunch. And then he tried to make us stay the night to stay with him, you know. And everywhere we go, this has been the experience. We'll go to these really intense, difficult situations, and then people will see that we're there to really try to report the true story, what happened. And the generosity, the warmth, the openness, and the welcoming has just been really beyond anything I've ever experienced. It's been really incredible. So I've made many friends.
We have had two Iraqi women on. They're touring the United States right now. Amal Al-Qadari, she is the founder director of Al-Bit Al-Iraqi, an arts and cultural center. Unfortunately, it was bombed and destroyed. And Nermeen Al-Mufti. Nermeen is an internationally recognized Iraqi journalist. And both of them wanted Americans listening to them here to understand the Iraqi people better and to know the Iraqi people. And in that way, for us to start a dialogue directly between Iraqis and Americans and bypassing the government here and what might pass for a government there. What do you think of that, Dar?
I think that's a great idea. I think that's critical. I personally have been trying to just take more photos of just people going about their everyday life here, because mainstream media in the U.S. does not show this. They don't show people with smiles on their face and children, and unless it's a sort of propaganda that suits them. And yes, just getting an email contact, like an email pen pal, so to speak, or something like this. We had an idea of trying to, have a webcam, and an idea of having dialogue in universities, just bringing some Iraqis up and having a question and answer session, this sort of thing. I think that's absolutely critical, because I think one way that atrocities like this invasion happen is by completely dehumanizing a people. And we need to, get away from this. Iraq is just Saddam Hussein, to know Iraq is a beautiful country with 26 million people, and in so many ways just like us. And yeah, I think that's a very critical point.
Now, tell us a little bit about the gentleman that you've been writing home about that was shot in the abdomen. How is he doing? Do you know? Or
last I heard, he is doing okay. As I had talked about before, the hospital situation is really a bit dismal here. But no, as far as I know, he's doing okay.
Okay. And getting back again to what's going on there with American forces interacting with the Iraqis, the Iraqis have a very strange leadership vacuum. More symbolically now with the capture and arrest of Saddam Hussein, but certainly throughout this invasion and occupation process, there has been a large void in leadership on the part of Iraqis being able to have a voice in their country. How is that affecting the violence level, do you think? And what evidence do you have to sort of support any theories one way or another about how the violence can be stopped?
Well, you know, with the capture of Saddam Hussein, even to the people who suffered the most under his regime, I spoke even with some of them, and while they're happy for his capture, they're still a bit dismayed because, in a sense, Saddam was a symbol of, you know, something that would stand up against, you know, Western hegemony here, and they are. They're forlorn. They're shot. There is kind of this, okay, where do we go? Where do we go from here? What do we do? And they don't have a voice. You know, speaking about it politically, the Iraqi Governing Council, every single Iraqi I've spoken with here, whether they were pro-Saddam or anti-Saddam or, you know, well, you know, wanted the Americans to come or not, everyone believes the IGC is completely bogus. It's full of people that were not elected by any Iraqi. They were appointed by the U.S. government, by the CPA here. And they don't. Everyone here just knows as soon as the Americans quit guarding the IGC, they're going to be smashed. They don't want them here. They want true elections. They want to elect Iraqis. They want to elect Iraqis that were here, suffered through the sanctions, through the wars, not people that were sitting in France in exile. And I think if you, as far that leads into probably the best thing to do to start to curb the violence is just the, you know, the saying that we've been hearing is, you know, let Iraqis run Iraq. You know, let them rebuild Iraq. They have the expertise. There's more PhDs per capita in Iraq than any other country on earth. They know how to rebuild their own country. They've already rebuilt it through after the Iran war, after the first Gulf War, through the sanctions. They know how to do it better than anyone. And they want to elect their own people, let their own people represent them. And if that would occur and the U.S. would begin to pull out and get some U.N. in here while that occurs in the meantime, that seems to be the consensus here on the ground with Iraqis is probably what would be the best solution to start curbing the violence.
Are you getting any kind of hopeful information from American leaders or leaders within the U.S. military system at all that would give you any kind of hope?
No. You know, that's, I don't know what else to say. You know, no is a complete sentence, right? There's not. Whether it's by the military or by any of the politicians at home who are calling the shots here, there is none. And that's got to be one of the most difficult things, one of the things I see weighing the most heavily on my friends, my Iraqi friends here, is that unless there is literally a 180-degree shift in policy by the military and the political leadership at home, this is only going to continue to degrade. It's really bad now. It's getting worse daily. And unless massive change happens on both those sides, it's not going to change. And so that's the longer version of my no to your answer.
Let me ask you, too. You've talked about sort of preemptive acts against demonstrators, and you've talked about the taking of pictures of some of these kids that you've said were targeted after a demonstration. Do you get the sense that there are intelligence operations running against Iraqis at this point? And if so, do you think that's going to make things worse?
Oh, absolutely. Basically, everything about the U.S. policy here on the ground is doing nothing but fueling the fires that already burn. There's more intelligence running around here. For example, the Baghdad Hotel, everyone here in Iraq calls it the CIA Hotel. Everyone knows it's all CIA. The Sheridan is chock full of CIA. You see them running around everywhere in their nice white SUVs. Because every other car on the road is dilapidated and beat down for the most part, so they stand out. there's they're just everywhere here. And then this sort of thing, another thing that occurred using the student demonstration as an example, is when we were there at the front of the school on the Hummers, there were two Humvees out front with loudspeakers, and the U.S. military was using an Iraqi interpreter, and my interpreter interpreted what he was blurting out over the loudspeakers to the crowds that had gathered in front of the school, and he was saying, you know, everyone go home. You know, this is, and there was going to be a demonstration the next day as well. And they were telling people, do not come to the demonstration tomorrow. And no matter what happens, do not come to this demonstration. And so when they do this, of course, you know, what are people going to do? There was a demonstration, and it was much, much, much larger than the one preceding it. So everything that they're doing is having this boomerang effect, as example by that.
It does sound an awful lot like the comparison people have been making between the occupied territories and Israel, the Palestinians and the Israelis, is a good comparison, that there are tactics that seem very similar there. Have you or anyone else heard about anything like that?
Oh, absolutely. It's documented by many news sources. There have been training at Fort Bragg. They've been bringing over Israeli personnel and training them on collective punishment, on all these things that they've been instituting in Israel for decades now. And we're seeing it right in front of our faces. You drive down the highway going out of Baghdad, and you see huge swaths of foliage that have been, you know, completely removed, trees literally pulled down. collective punishments going on in force as we speak in towns. They're literally sectioning off towns, surrounding the entire village by razor wire, patrolling it with soldiers, and having one entry and exit that's through a military guarded port, issuing these ID cards with people's photo on them written in English, and people, if they live in the town, if they don't have one of these cards, they're not going to get in or out. They're weighing embargoes on towns. I was in Ramadi about a week ago. The people were furious because they're down to about 2 hours of electricity a day, running water. They don't have it most of the time. So entire cities are being targeted by these kind of heavy-handed tactics by the military. So it's just a complete onslaught of the tactics which are being used by the Israelis against the Palestinians.
Did you get the impression when you were there at the school and these kids were being taken away and pressured, did you get the impression that another tactic would have worked better, that they were kids that could have been talked with?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I spoke at length with an English teacher, a very nice English teacher at the school when I went back the following day. And he was at the demonstration with the students. And he went out with them and spoke with them and said, look, first he tried to dissuade them from having the demonstration. And he said, look, you know, this isn't a good idea. It's a very tense situation. I know you're just screwing around, but, you know, you really don't need to do this. Just save it for another time. And they had the demonstration anyway. They're high school kids, right? Go figure. And he was there at the demonstration, and the whole time he was saying, look, just go home. And he watched it all happen. And then the same thing, when the soldiers came back the next day to get to collect the kids, he walked around through the school with the soldiers before they started going into the classrooms and dragging them out. And he said, look, you know, they're just kids. They're just messing around. We'll keep talking to them some more. Just let this go. You know, just let this go. This time will pass. And so this certainly, just dialogue and just, you know, giving it some time and letting the people start to sort it out for themselves would be a far better policy.
It does seem to be one of the dangers of this administration's tactic of constantly talking about the dangers and pointing up the dangers posed by the Iraqi people one way or another in such overblown ways, you know, as relates to students being trained in terrorism or as it relates to Saddam Hussein's supporters. It sounds very much like the administration of George Bush is not open to that kind of a policy.
Well, that whole mindset of basically just because someone whose country you've invaded is fighting against being occupied, so therefore they're a terrorist. I've gone in and spoken with, it happened at the student demonstration, it happened when I go in and talk with people after their homes have been raided by the military and they're innocent, and, you know, they're people have been killed, their family members have been killed or detained, and then they always ask me, who's the terrorist here? Who is the terrorist here? You know, we're here minding our own business. If they want to come search our home, if they just come knock and ask, we'll let them in, but they storm in. There's another situation I went to in Ramadi where they stormed a home, they took the men outside, they laid them face down in the mud, in the rain, and then they executed the three of them. They shot them all in the back, and then they left. And then they came back the next day. They said, well, we had the wrong information on your house. We were told the resistance was here. We know that it's wrong. And that was it. The family was not compensated. They still have not been compensated. And, of course, the people ask me, who is the terrorist here? It's a wordplay, saying that someone in Iraq is a terrorist simply because they're fighting against their country being occupied, or simply because they come back and want revenge against troops who have killed a family member. They're a terrorist. It's propaganda, saying that that's what's going on. There's yet to be any conclusive proof that there's any more than maybe 5,000-6,000 tops foreign fighters in Iraq, and most of the people fighting and most of the people have been detained are Iraqis, and the majority of them are people who are simply trying to defend their own country.
Have you found that the mainstream press will take stories like the one you just described of those Iraqis being executed?
No, and that's a very good question, and I'm very glad you asked it. I will try to keep my head about this one, but I've written many, many pieces about this sort of thing going on, and I have had absolutely zero published in any sort of mainstream press at all, whether it be a newspaper or magazine or any, or even a website. And many of my other independent journalist friends who are here have experienced the same frustration. We'll be on this big rush, like we'll have this big story and it'll be very intense and extremely emotional, and then we'll write it up and then we'll send it out to as many people as we can to try to get some people to run this, to get the truth out, and nobody will pick these stories up. One editor, you know, most of the time we don't hear anything back at all, but one editor even wrote back and said, well, this is not news.
And is that because one of the mainstream American TV networks wasn't on the scene, do you think?
No, because we will report on something, for example, what happened in Samarra. You heard about this probably 2 weeks ago. The mainstream media in the U.S. reported, as reported by the CPA, consequently, that there was a large, highly organized attack on a U.S. convoy in Samarra that was helping a delivery of money to one of the banks, you know, highly coordinated, and they killed 54 Fedayeen fighters, and they suffered no casualties. We went to the scene 4 days later, and I checked with the hospital. I went in the hospital. I spoke with the administrator. I spoke with wounded people in the hospital. I went to the morgue, and there were eight Iraqis killed, and one Iranian, and who was there on a pilgrimage to the mosque. And there's a few other independent journalists who have gone and verified the same thing. And the military, to this day, stuck to their figure of 54 killed. And the story simply never got changed, despite the fact that the entire city, people that we spoke with in tea shops and in a mosque and in the hospital, one of the sheikhs there, everyone verified our figures. And still, all you hear is there's a big battle and 54 Fedayeens were killed. So this is the frustration. It's a complete media blackout for anything, any kind of news that contradicts what the CPA wants to come out of Iraq.
Dar Jamail, you are an American in an unfriendly place. What do you think that U.S. troops are thinking when they see you? Do they recognize you as an independent journalist doing a job? Or are you having any kind of problem with that?
You know, I get mixed reaction because, you know, not all troops here are bad. You know, I mean, you know, for the most part, I still believe the majority of them are people just... they're here. They don't want to be here. They're doing the best they can. They just want to get the hell out. But I have encountered problems. I mean, you know, it's hard to get any of them to speak with us. For example, it's obvious that they have orders not to talk with journalists unless it's in some carefully crafted Fox type situations. But the ones I have spoken with, for example, they're not happy. You know, they want to go home. They're angry. They're angry because they've had a leave date and it's been changed on them and pushed back over and over. But that's been another source of frustration as far as, because I have wanted to do some reports with some troops and finding anyone that will really, really get honest with me and really, you know, even have some time to speak with me or some of the other independent journalists is really next to impossible. It's obvious that there's a bit of a gag order on them from up high. As far as being in danger around them, it's definitely something that we have to pay attention to. Statistically, there's been more journalists killed in the invasion and then the ensuing occupation, proportionally more journalists killed than there have been coalition troops. Or I think a better way to phrase that is, if you're a journalist here, the odds of you being killed are higher than if you're a coalition soldier.
Can you provide any statistics on that? I've not heard anything about that, numbers of journalists being killed being that high.
Yeah, it's been very high. You don't hear about it often. You heard about it some during the the invasion, but it continues to occur. That's something I will... I actually have the hard numbers, but I don't know them right off the top of my head. I'll have to get back to you on that one.
Well, I look forward to talking with you again. Before we end here, I do want to ask a question about something that Donald Rumsfeld made reference to at his open house Christmas party in Washington, D.C. That was attended by NPR's Cokie Roberts, and she was interviewed and discussed it. And it was right after Saddam Hussein was captured. And apparently Donald Rumsfeld made reference to the money and said that we should look at the money in the situation and that the Husseins had taken large amounts of new American bills from banks when they left Baghdad. And so they had traced where these people went from that money. I want to ask you about money in general, though. There was a lot floating around in Iraq upon arrival of U.S. troops, and there were news stories about the fact that the American forces were giving out money, as well as playing cards with the faces and names of targeted Iraqis. Have you heard any stories about money? And if so, what have they been like?
Well, I certainly haven't heard stories of people being well off or, you know, happy because troops showed up and gave them a bunch of Saddam's money. You telling me that now, I'll try not to laugh. That's the first I've heard of that. Money, the economic situation here is atrocious. The dinar is completely a link to the U.S. dollar as to its value, and it's been plummeting daily as the dollar continues to plummet against the euro. People here are not making ends meet. Saddam, as terrible of a dictator as he may have been, he had a really good infrastructure system. Education was covered, and really good subsidies for the farmers. And now people can't make ends meet. Unemployment's over 60% and growing. The dinar is plummeting. And just the cost to fill up people's car with the current gas situation, people can't make ends meet. It's really an atrocious situation economically. Over in Sadr City, even the CPA's figures, I'll even use their own figures, they kicked 70,000 people out of what was formerly government-subsidized housing. That's 70,000 families, according to them, which means it's most likely far worse. There's children on the streets begging, you know, on every other corner, women begging, men, you know, selling little black plastic garbage bags, to sell. People can't get enough to eat here. So the money question is a very big topic. I could go into this at length. I've done a couple of pieces on it, but it's really, really a very difficult time here, and it's only getting worse. And, you have engineers and people with PhDs and college professors driving old beat up taxis in the street just to try to feed their families. So that's the money situation in Iraq today.
Finally, Dar Jamail, give us some parting words about this time of year. In Iraq, we've just seen a very violent Ramadan. Now it's a Christian holiday in America and the world. Has anything changed as a consequence of these sentiments of peace and goodwill that come with both of those holidays, or has it pretty much been ignored?
No, those are superfluous at this point over here. People are trying to get by on a daily basis. People are hoping that when they send their child to school, if they send their child to school, that their child will not be kidnapped or raped. People are hoping that when they go down the street to the market, they will not be shot by a U.S. soldier because they thought that someone fired on their convoy. So thoughts of a holiday are really not real high on people's priority list here. The only thing I could say about thoughts of a holiday are a lot of people are concerned that around Christmas time here, there's going to be some really heavy attacks against the Americans, similar to what we saw perhaps at the start of Ramadan with all the terrible suicide bombings in Baghdad. So that's really about the only holiday sentiment at this point that us over here in Baghdad are real concerned about.
Any sentiments for people at home that you might be missing at this time of year, Dar?
Well, I definitely feel a long way from home here, that's for sure. But I feel very passionately about being here, and it's a job that needs to be done, and I really hope that maybe someone that is on the fence listening to this will hear it and come over and start doing something similar. It's risky, but I think it's extremely important because people back home just have absolutely, especially going through the holidays, which is a really special time and generally a time to get together with family and friends. But over here, it's a crisis situation, and people are dying every single day here. The war has not ended in Iraq. People are starving. People don't have medical supplies. And it's a really, really dire situation here. So if it is truly the time of giving for this holiday, I would encourage people to get on the Internet, contact some sources, Red Crescent. There's, Electronic Iraq has some good sources on their website on what you can do to help out, because people over here really need it, to put it mildly.
Dar, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us from Iraq.
Thank you very much for having me, Dori.
Journalist Dar Jamail joined us by satellite phone from Iraq. You can read his articles online at electronicirac.net. For Regime Change Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program was produced in the studios of listener-supported WHUS Stores, Radio for the People. You can hear it online at whus.org. You can write to me with your comments on this program at rcrradio@aol.com. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or the University of Connecticut.